after that introduction, I don't know that we need another introduction. A little over a year ago, I met Virginia at State Assembly, and in working with her on the Archive Committee, I've come to know and love her quite a bit. She's a super lady. People that get as involved in service work as she does has to really be grateful to be sober in this program. And I am looking very much forward to hearing your story. So, Virginia.
I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic, and my name is Virginia.
Hi,
everybody. I first want to recognize my higher power for giving me this day, clean and sober, into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for teaching me how to live this new life I've been granted. It is truly an honor and a pleasure to be here tonight. I'm a long way from home, and I have my net with me, so, you know, I brought some friends with me. They told me don't go anywhere by yourself until you get sober. Well, see, I'm not quite all that sober yet. So I bring my network with me, and there's some on the road tonight that didn't make it. I don't know where they are, but hopefully they will call before it's too late, and whatever too late is, and say they need help. Sometimes we have a little problem asking for help, you know. And you know how the men... No, I won't say that. But I do appreciate Ruth for asking me out. I am a little nervous. All of a sudden, I feel like I should have went to the bathroom again. But I didn't, so I got to stay here. I was like the young man about falling off the stage. It's very close, so I'm going to hold on. My story really begins I just ask my higher power to let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, my strength and my redeemer. Today, I do have a higher power, and he is the head of my life, and I try not to do anything until I've asked God to lead and guide me in my recovery, show me how to live. I could get up here and tell you a lot of stuff, but if that's not what I'm supposed to say, then it may be empty, and I don't want it to be empty. Not always just for you, but for myself, because I am serious about my program. I try to have fun and enjoy myself, but I'm still serious about my recovery. My story did begin November the 10th, 1990, and that's not so long ago for some, but it seems like a lifetime for me. I was a sick, suffering alcoholic, an addict, and I knew nothing else to do, and I knew nowhere else to go. I began in another fellowship because somehow I had realized that drugs had gotten the best of me. And I was on my knees November the 4th, which was my belly button birthday. And I'm not going to break any traditions and talk about drugs, but in order for you to know what happened, I have to tell you a little bit about it just to let you know. November the 4th was my birthday. And I had did the geographical cure. I ran away from home in Michigan to get away from the drugs and alcohol. And I'll tell you a little bit about how I got here a little later on. But I'd left a 15-year-old son there in Michigan. And he'd taken the time to call me up on my birthday and to say happy birthday to me here in Georgia. But I was so sick and burnt out from using the drugs. I had blisters in my mouth. My hands were all messed up. My stomach was turning over, doing the flip-flops. I couldn't get out of the bed. I couldn't go to the bathroom because I might miss something. I didn't have time to bathe. I had the shades drawn, and I was laid on the floor with candles because I didn't want anybody to see my light on in my room night and day. And I was real miserable. And I wondered what had happened to me because I thought I wasn't the ugliest person in the world. I wasn't the stupidest person in the world. What had happened? And when I hear them read, and they say that God could and would if he were sought. And that night after my son called me, I couldn't talk to him because I was too sick. The guilt was on me. And I got on my knees beside my bed. I had a plate of the other stuff. I had a case of Budweiser. I didn't even like Budweiser. I had a fifth of some kind of liquor. It's my birthday. You know you got to have triple when it's your birthday. And I was trying to do it all, y'all. But it wasn't working very good. And I hear a lot of people say what they had to do to get their drugs and alcohol. Seemed like all I had to do was open the door, and there it was. I couldn't keep it away from me. So I was on my knees at my bed on November the 4th, 1990. And for the first time, I think I said a real prayer. I mean, from my heart, I said, God, please, please help me. Please help me. Well, a little missionary church had started in my, I lived down on the boulevard in the heart of the drug scene. They even wrote an article in the Creative Loafing that if you needed good drugs, come down and where Virginia was. Well, they didn't say Virginia, but they said boulevard, and I thought I was the queen of the boulevard, so I thought they were saying come down to where I was. And that church had started up, and they were coming door to door, and they came to my door, and the minister was the first positive thing that had happened to me since I got here to Georgia. Now, I came in 1987, and I took his hand tentatively, and I went to that church, and I used to cry, just cry. I'd stay up all night drinking and drugging so I'd be up in time to go to church, because see, by the time church started, it was my time to go to sleep. 7-8 o'clock in the morning. So I used to drink and drug all night so I could be up and go to church. So finally, I cried so much, he asked me, he says, what's wrong with it? I says, well, I finally admitted I had a little drinking problem. Just a little. So he said, well, what do you think would help you? And I said, I think I need therapy. And that man was kind enough to call a therapist friend of his, pay that woman to come to my house. And she came to my apartment building. I was running a rooming house. And she came there. Well, I'm the kind of alcoholic, I can't allow you to do too much for me, because that would mean that I'm weak. And if he would go so far as to have a therapist come to my house, I would take a step and do something about it. Well, see, things come together. I believe there's no coincidence once you're on the right path. And my daughter called me and she says, you know, Mama, I'm in treatment. I'm saying, what? She says, I'm in treatment. I finally surrendered. And I said, you know, I probably need to go to treatment too, but what would people say about my career? And she said, what career, Mama? Well, I know I got a career here somewhere. But my career had been getting more drugs, getting more alcohol. And the demons were coming out of the walls on me. They were coming out of the vents, coming out behind the curtains. And the more I would drink, the more they would come. And I finally listened to what she said, and I gave it up. I didn't have a career. My career had fell through. And so by November the 10th, I went into treatment at Fulton County Detox Center. One of the best things, folks, that ever happened to me, going in there. I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know much about I didn't know anything about recovery. I had heard about AA along the lines, but they always said it was Alcoholics Anonymous. And see, being an intellectual I am, I thought that's where alcoholics went and drank anonymously, and nobody knew about them, right? No. And, I heard that Narcotics Anonymous meant never alone. And I didn't like that because I needed to be alone to do what I was doing because I really didn't want folks to know what I was doing. And I was hiding from everybody. And everybody knew. I was the only one who didn't know. I was the one who was totally in the dark. Well, anyway, I had went down to that treatment center about three different times, and each time I'd dress up, fix up, paint up, put my pretty dress on, put my makeup on, and I'd go in there and I'd say, my name's Virginia Scott. And they say, yes, what can we do for you? First question, I'd blew it every time. I'd get mad as heck, and I'd leave out of there. Doggone them people, what did I want? I don't know what I want. So you know that window only opens sometimes, just a very little. And I would go back, and maybe a month or so, that window would open again. I'd be at that wit's end, and I'd go back, fix up, paint up. I'd go back down there, say, I'm Virginia Scott. And they say, how can we help you? God damn it, there they go again. And I'd leave out of there again, and I'd go back. So the very last time, someone gave me a name down there, and I called this person. I said, tell me, how do you get in treatment? He says, go down there and tell them you're on dope and you need help. Tell them that, then they'll know. He said, they're going to need to know. So I went down there the next time. I put on my Tina Turner wig on. It was a little backwards, but that didn't make no difference. I put on my black fedora hat with the red feather sticking out of it, stingy brim, and I cocked it on the side. I put these funky jeans on because that meant I meant business when I had them jeans on. And I went back down there. I says, look here, I'm on dope and I need help. They said, come on in, Virginia. Well, I'll be darned. Why'd they do that the first time? Well, anyway, they took me upstairs and they began a process on me. And I don't know what they did. I was in a fog. I couldn't really hear. I couldn't really see. All I wanted to do was sleep because I'd been up 5 days and nights. Before I left, I had to rake that plate off in the trash can, and so I said, die. You gotta die. And I went in that treatment. 3 days later, the fog cleared a little bit, and I kind of shook myself, and I looked around. I asked somebody, I said, how long have I been here? They said, 3 days. 3 days. Blackout. I reached into my pocket, came out with them same little $10 I had. I jumped up. I said, I've been saved. I've been saved. And I sit your butt down. Ain't nobody saved. They thought I was talking about religion. But that wasn't it, folks. What I was talking about was the very first time in a very long time had I went 3 days and had some money and didn't have a drink or a drug or a pill or whatever it was. Very long time. For the first time, the lie for me had been exposed. Because by that time, I did not believe that I could live 24 hours without something. But if I could go 3 days, now I saw a lady jump over the railing, broke her leg. Man told her, said, jump, baby. She jumped, broke her leg, and I thought, now that's a dumb so-and-so. How is she going to cop with a broke leg? So I decided I wasn't going that way. And they said, don't go down the steps or they'll put you out. So I didn't go down the steps. So I started this patient wait. And I'm still in this patient wait, y'all. I said, if I could stay at 3 days, I'm going to try for 4. I'm going to try for 5. I'm going to try for 6. And it goes on day in and day out. And here I am, a little over 4 years, and guess what? I'm still trying for tomorrow. I'm still trying one day at a time. I want this program as bad today as I wanted it November the 10th, 1990, when I walked in Fulton County Treatment. I hear a lot of people say they fight the program. Sister does not fight. If you say do it, I try. You say read it in the book. Now I will go to the book on you because I hear a lot of misinformation in these rooms sometimes. I will go to the book. But then I do trust my sponsor and I trust a lot of y'all that come into my life. I believe in you. I see you staying sober. They told me the first thing you need to do is do some service work. So they said, sit the chairs up for the meeting. Well, I knew better I sit the chairs up another way. They told me to say, no, Virginia, sit the chairs up another way. I was intimidated. I thought the chairs were sitting in the wrong direction anyway. They should have said it that way, but they wouldn't let me sit the chairs that way. Then they told me to make the coffee, and I made the coffee one way. They says, no, Virginia, you got to make it another way. And I swallowed my pride, and I learned to make it the way I was told to make it. And today I'm still doing service work the way you tell me to do it. I know that for 40-odd years, I went on my own knowledge, my own strength. I set my course, and I followed my path, and that path led me to Fulton County Treatment Center and into these meetings. Today, I'm not so certain about my path. I do a little consultation, and I'm even able to admit when I'm wrong, when I'm being stubborn and pig-headed. I admitted it tonight when Ruth gave me explicit directions. Turn on the first exit and come to the Waffle House. But after I passed that exit, I decided to consult the paper and see what exit she told me to go up on. So I had to go around and come back. And I had to admit, there I go again, Miss Pig-headed Virginia. But see, today, I have a guideline. See, before I never had a guideline. Without this program, I never had a guideline. I didn't know. I did what I thought was the right thing, even if it was wrong. But today I have a guideline. Well, they took me out of Fulton Treatment Center, and they took me to a rehab, and we started working the steps. Another amazing development. I had admitted, because that guy told me I was an addict, how to get in Fulton Treatment Center. So I had admitted that I was an addict. But then I started on the steps, and guess what? I'm an alcoholic now. I've been drinking for 40 years. And only when I got in this program did I realize that I had went to the other things because I got so sick of being drunk all the time. I was a mean, low-down. I was a rough drunk, y'all. I was okay as long as you didn't cross me. But then I crossed so easy. Just the slightest little thing, and I was crossed, and then I went into it. And if something always had to die, I had to kill something, or something had to kill me, and I'd been shot at, stabbed, ran over, beat up, screwed up, and I'd come back for more. I ain't dead yet, you know. That was my attitude. Somebody always had to die. The rent was due. Somebody's got to die. I don't have the money. Kill the landlord. You know, that was always my attitude about everything. I couldn't talk about it. If it wasn't my way, you had to die. Well, when I started working those steps and I realized my first drink came when I was 9 years old. I come home from school one day and a bunch of boys grabbed me on the path and they molested me really bad, and my favorite little buddy was in the bunch, and he took me over to a log, and he sat down, and he reached in that log, and he brought out a bottle of Virginia Dare wine. Well, my name's Virginia, right? And there was a little white girl on the label, and she had her dress up, and she was doing like that with a bag of flowers in her hand, and I thought, if it's good enough for her, it should be good enough for me. And I took my first drink. Well, you know, one is too many and 1,000 are never enough. So I had to have another one and another one and another one. And after a while, even though it was nasty and it burned and I didn't like it, I kept on doing it. And after a while, I felt pretty good. Instead of going home telling my parents what had happened to me, I went home and I went to sleep. And when I woke up, I decided that those boys didn't really hurt me. They really loved me because I was really pretty and sexy, and because I was playing hard to get, they couldn't stand it and they took it. That was the very first lie that I drank on. And from that time on, whatever I drank on was a lie. And it continued to be a lie. And to this day, it's still a lie. But now I know the difference. Well, I didn't drink for a while after that. But when I got to this program, I found out that my drinking wasn't always because of the drink. It was because the things I couldn't stand in life. I'd been born to an unwed mother. My father was Haitian. My mother was Canadian. My mother was kind of, in black culture, we pray a lot on color. You know, if you're light and got good hair, in pretty good shape. If you're black, get back. Well, my Haitian father was black, and my mother was light, with nice, cold hair, kind of French Creole. She had nice hair. My father come from Haiti, had short hair, and he's black like me. So my grandfather put my mother out. She had to go to the women's shelter to have me. And when she says, when she took me home, and my grandfather looked at me, he said, "No, you cannot bring this baby in here. I was just too black." So I was already under a problem. I already had a resentment because I lived with a foster mother, and finally my foster father left. So you see, I begin to feel like, hey, nobody loved me. I'm just unlovable. They used to take me, and my mother would come and get me to Canada, and she'd say, "Now, baby, when we go to Canada, I want you to speak clearly and speak like this and talk plain so people can understand you." And I'd say, "Yes, mother." And when I'd get to Canada, they'd say, "Who is that?" Because I was the dark skin in the light group, right? And they'd say, "That's Irma's mistake." And then I would always say, "And that's your mistake." And the fight was on. And when we'd get back in the car, coming back to across the bridge, my mother would always say, "Baby, why are you all beat up like that?" I said, "Yeah, y'all ought to see the other ones, you know." I was a scrappy little something, you know. I would hang right on in there with the best of them. You could whip my butt. That didn't stop me. You didn't kill me. If you didn't kill me, I kept coming. And then I would go with my father's people. And my father would say, "Honey, why do you talk like that? Why don't you talk like this? You say, mom talk like this." I said, "Yeah, daddy, we talk like this." Well, I get back home and there were a bunch of Southern kids live next door to me. And I'd come on, "Hi, mom, how you doing?" They said, "Why do you talk like that? Why don't you talk like we talk? We don't know what, oh yeah, right, I talk like y'all talk." So I thought I was bilingual for the longest time. I told them I spoke Haitian, I spoke French, and I spoke Southern. And I could speak between. So I went to having these problems very early on. I resented it because I didn't think my mother loved me. I would fight my mother. I knew my mother. She lived around the corner. She married again. She'd catch me and say something to me, and I'd try to kill her. I never did, but I'd try. And later on, when the first time that I had sex was an awful affair, I was looking for love in all the wrong places. I was about 12 years old, and my mother met me on the path home, and I was degraded again. And she went to messing with me about why I wasn't at home. Street lights was on, you know, and I tried to take my anger out on my mother. I tried to beat her to death on that path. She was a little bit bigger than me, and I went home with another ass whipping. But that was okay. I got a few in on her, really. I think I was in my late 30s before I gave up trying to fight my mother whenever she said something to me that I didn't like. Well, I went on with these resentments, and about 13, I got pregnant, I got married, and I had a baby every year from there on. I was angry because I felt like Santa Claus was over for me at 13. Now I had to provide Christmas for others. And I rapidly had 7 children. By the time I was 22 years old, I had 7. 4 boys and 3, how many? 4 girls and 3 boys. And I was a basket case. I was suicidal. I was angry. I'd gotten married. My husband fed into my insanity. He became suicidal. And we were standing in front of cars, cutting our wrists, drinking poison, slashing our arms, just I think the very last time I slashed my wrist, the doctor knew me. He says, you know, Virginia, I wish you'd try the other arm because we can't find any place to sew this one up. And I carry the scars today of that. But you know, the promises say that our experiences will benefit others. I never thought that an experience could benefit anybody else. But I see today that it has. And I work with other women that have tendencies in this area. Well, after about the seventh child, I said, that's enough, I'm through with it. And I left the kids, and I told the kids, they had a song out there and said, we'll kill lions in a ditch and with a toothpick, and we're going to stay together. And I took my kids, and we moved to another part of Michigan. I'm going kind of fast because there's a whole lot of stuff in my story. But I know I don't have time to tell all of it, so I'm just highlighting it maybe. And I want to get to my recovery. I met a man down there, and he kind of started hanging out with me, and he was a very jealous man. And my drinking escalated, and I was hanging out with 14 brothers, and these brothers used to play with me, and I wasn't involved with the brothers intimately. They were all coming from the south to this little complex I stayed in, and they were about my age, and they started hanging around my house, around my kids, and we'd pool our food together, drink, and do other things. And my boyfriend just couldn't believe I wasn't having sex with these guys, and he started beating on me. It's the only time I've really been in an abusive relationship. Now you remember, well, he made it great. Well, you remember I said that I was the type that you had to kill. So this guy was a huge guy. And I don't know how he went to his grave, but we stabbed each other, we shot each other. We fought wherever we could fight. And it didn't happen till after we got drunk. And that's when we would fight. Finally, I got out of that relationship, and I got with someone else. Tried to get my life together, got my own house. I had me a pretty good job. I was dealing out of the house. The kids was my doorman. They knew how to let who in and let who out. And I was real messed up. I was a binger there. I would binge on them weekends and holidays and birthdays and, you know how you binge. And they would throw it all. They used to call us the Green Gang, because my last name was Green then. And I took those children right along with me. Today I'm still making amends to my children. There are some chasm between us, but we're doing better with each other than we had in the past. I really didn't realize what I had done. I did not realize that alcoholism touches everyone around us. I didn't realize that. I thought it was my problem. I go in my room and I got drunk, but I didn't realize how it affected those children. I gave my oldest daughter the fits because she became the mother. She mothered me, she mothered the rest of the children. And when I got pregnant, I was in college about to do good, and doggone if I didn't get pregnant for the eighth time. All of the kids left home at the same time. I couldn't believe that. They said, Mama, we're not going to raise another one of your children. And I was real angry with them. How could they leave me when I'm pregnant? Well, they all left home, and I was there with that one child, and I was not ready for that one child. And even though I had stuck with those seven, I could not stick. That eighth child was a different kind of child. He talked back. I raised my hand to chastise, and he raised his hand to chastise me. I thought, I'm going to kill this kid. I know I'm close to being a child abuser. I'm going to kill him, you know. And the last time we had a terrible fight, and I had my fist balled up on him, and I said, this is it. And that's when the seed was planted that I got to run away. I know if I stay there, I would get no help with him. And this is when the seed was planted to run away. Now, let me tell you about the running away. I wanted to get away from the drugs and the alcohol. I thought if I get away from my environment, I'd do better. Somehow I had that innate. And I wasn't going to use heavy drugs. I was into the smoking the crack by that time. But I was tired of that. I didn't like that anymore. It was getting to be too much for me. So I said, I'm not going to do that anymore. And I was in a motorcycle club. I was riding a motorcycle. I'd been riding it since the baby was born before. I almost went to the hospital and had that child on the motorcycle because that was where I was. And I was obsessive about that motorcycle. I would go to work. I thought I was a Wonder Woman. I'd run in the bathroom and change my clothes and go to work in my heels. And at evening, I'd run in the bathroom, put all my leather and lace back on and jump on that bike. And I always wondered, why am I doing this? Why am I doing this? But I never answered it. I just kept on doing it. So I got on this bike, and we were going to Chicago. And I decided I wouldn't take any drugs with me. I just had some marijuana, some Black Beauties. And I fixed a thermos on the back of the bike with some frozen daiquiris. And I took a douchebag hose and I taped it to the I taped it in the thermos and I run the hose to the helmet so I could drink it dry. Well, halfway down the road the daiquiris ran out. I was on my own. And I was riding with different bikers. They'd ride with me. They would come up and they'd kick the bike and wake me up, you know. And I'm, dummy, don't kick the bike. You scare me half to death when you kick the bike. It never occurred to me that they were trying to wake me up because I was sleeping on the motorcycle. But see, my motorcycle knew me and it knew how to stay in the road. And I didn't need them kicking on my bike to wake me up. Just leave me the heck alone. I'd be all right. Along about Kentucky, I remember going to sleep under a van, and when I woke up, it was wet and cold, and the van was gone. And they just left me out here in the field asleep. I said, there's something wrong with this, you know. I left the drugs at home, but here I am out in the field, and there's nowhere, just me and the bike. Well, I got up, and I caught another crew, and we came to Atlanta. 2 days into Atlanta, we were riding, I was riding, I had been to some club and I had on these hot pants and somebody asked me to get on their bike and they showed me that, them drugs, and I got on the bike and as soon as we took off from the clubhouse, we had a serious accident and my last words were, you're all going to kill me. And I almost got killed. They broke every rib in this side of my body. I came to in Grady, and the motorcycle club, they rallied to me. They made sure I had plenty of drugs and alcohol to get through the pain. So when I got up out of there, I was back on crack again, and I was drinking. I had some big old bottle set by the bed, and I just, whenever the pain would come, I would drink first and then drug, and drink first and then drug. So I got up from there. And I got a job, and someone told me on the boulevard I was going to be a rooming house manager. And I thought, that's great. In Michigan, the boulevard is a pretty nice place to be in my hometown. That's where the doctors and lawyers lived. Excuse me. Well, when I came over there, it was cold. And I didn't see anything, and I thought, I have arrived. But the sun came out. Awful thing, y'all. Awful thing. Awful, awful thing. And my disease just, it went crazy, y'all, until that day I walked at Fulton County Treatment Center. And from then to now, things have changed. I found out that I could not, in that treatment center, that rehab, I found out that I could not live life on life's terms. I expected everything to be just the way I wanted it. And when it wasn't, I needed something to lean on. And I had found alcohol to be the best crutch. I had problems with men because they were always abandoning me. So I wasn't too sure about the men. When I needed a man, I took one hostage. And then I either had to kill him or he tried to kill me so that we could break up and I could get me another one. And it went on like that and on. I would quit drinking and I would get to the point where I felt pretty confident that I wasn't going to drink anymore. And something would say, Virginia, you can have a beer. Beer's not your problem. Just one beer. And I'd say, dog straight, I can have a beer. Just one. And I would drink that beer. And I'd say, see, I knew I'd be all right. And I'd have another one. And finally, I would get so relaxed, I'd say, the hell with the beer. Give me a drink. And then I would get that drink, and I would get even more relaxed. And the next thing I knew, I had something else in my mouth. And I would hit bottom, and I'd go for that period of abstinence. And my disease would say, Virginia, you could have a beer. Beer's not your problem. I say, yeah, right. And I was back in it over and over and over, year in and year out. And only when I came into this program did I begin to see the method to my madness. Only when I got here and I looked at that first step, and I admitted that every time I drank, I got drunk. No matter what I drank, I always got drunk. And I always drank when something was going on. And something was always going on. And it still is always going on. But the steps begin to unlock things for me. And when I'm standing here tonight, I know that I'm doing a fifth step. I know that when I admit to God, to myself, and all of you, the nature of my wrongs, that I'm getting better in that area. I know that I still have resentments, fears. I know that I'm still human. I'm so far from being the perfect person that I always thought I was. But what is so amazing is that I have found it out. Sometimes I get upset because my recovery didn't come sooner. I went to a meeting and they did a countdown, and someone stood up there and he got 44 years clean and sober. See, I don't think I'm going to make that. I don't think I'm going to get 44 years. I might. I'm going to work on it, but I'm not so sure I'll get 44 years. Why couldn't I have been 20? Well, someone else told me that I had to drink every drink. I had to do all that I did to get the recovery I've gotten. And so I'm learning not to look back with regret, but to see the positiveness in what's going on in my life. Today, when adversity overcomes, and it sometimes does, I don't always look at the negative side. I look at the positive side, because I have learned when something goes wrong, if I do the right thing for the right reason, there's always a blessing right behind it. I was going to Biloxi in December to the Southeastern Forum, and just before I'm getting ready to go, I get a letter about the car insurance. There's not going to be any car insurance in 24 hours. And my disease is, don't go to Biloxi. Pay the car insurance. Now, can you imagine the resentment I could have sit up all week with that car insurance pay and not went to Biloxi? But I chose my recovery, and I went on to Biloxi. And when I came back, I'm still running a rooming house for people clean and sober in recovery. Somebody came in and they took a room for a whole month, and I had enough money to pay off that car insurance. And the more I work this program, the more I have faith in my recovery, the better it gets for me. The more I turn over my life over to a power greater than myself, the better it gets for me. I've stopped worrying so much about what Virginia could do. And I ask God to do for me what I can't do for myself. You all tell me to stay in service work. I'm the rotating out GSR of my group. And I felt really kind of neglected about that. I was the founder of that group. And they didn't vote me back in for GSR. My God, what's wrong with them? I mean, how are they going to run this group without me? And my sponsor says, maybe your higher power has something greater for you. Oh, yeah, right. Soon as I went to focusing on something positive, I got out of the negative. And today I look for the positive. My disease will have me look for the negative. It will always have me look for what's wrong. You can tell me I look good and I'll show you where my dress is torn in the back. That's my disease. I know it now. I know it now. I know it when I see it, when it goes off in my head and tells me, kick their butts, Virginia. I know it. I know that's my disease. Today I choose not to. About 2 years ago, I came home with my children from Christmas, and I got a phone call on the 5th of January, and one of my kids says, Mom, says, your son has just been murdered, and you need to come back home. I was like, oh, Lord. And I was running through that airport, and I saw all these signs, and I saw every beer sign in that airport, y'all. And my seat partner, I had told him the mission I was on. He was a minister. And we had a 45-minute layover in Cleveland before I could get a flight out of there to Detroit. And I'm sitting in a little bar eating a sandwich, and they're drinking these pitchers of beer. They're passing it back and forth. And some said to me, "Oh, baby, do you need a pitcher of that beer?" And I says, "No, I'm making it." I was talking to myself. "No, I'm making a choice today. I'm not going to drink about this. I'm not going to drink. But I kept watching that beer. I didn't take my eyes off of it. Every time a glass would go up, I could swallow, I could taste it. Finally, my seat partner come over to me and he says, "Virginia, if you come now, I can get you on a flight to Detroit." I knew my higher power was working. You just don't go in airports and get flights out of there in 5 minutes when you're going to wait 45 minutes. And I jumped on that plane, coattails flying, and I went on to Michigan without that 45-minute wait. And see, these kind of things are building my faith in that third step. They're building my faith that if I believe, if I just believe, if I just don't give up believing, it'll all be all right. It's got to be all right, because see, I don't have anything else. I do not have any other options in my life. If this program doesn't work, what's next? I have already experimented with everything I know to experiment. I went to school. I got a master's. I was so drunk when they gave me the master's degree, I didn't even know what to do with it. Lost it. I don't know where. I probably left it in the bar. That didn't work. I went to the church and that didn't work. It's working now because I've gotten an idea of what my disease is about. I'm all for church and religion and all of that, but my main focus is on my disease because I know I'm an alcoholic and an addict. And if I don't keep the focus on my problem, I don't know. I'm not sure what might help me, and I really don't want to test the waters. I don't need to test it today. I need to learn the love that's in my heart that I believe my higher power wants me to learn to love me first, to love my higher power first, and to love other people. I used to have a resentment because it seemed like everyone always came to me for what they needed. I was like, where the hell am I going to get it from? When I got in this program, I realized that God gave it to me to give. And if I kept these hands closed, nothing could ever come into it. I manage a room and house now, and people are always knocking on my door, "Virginia, loan me this, give me this, do this to it." And I mean, don't go. I said, okay. Because I know the minute I give it away, it comes back double. Every time I do it. But I have an instant forgetter. Someone told me we alcoholics suffer from CRS. Can't remember shit. I can't. I tell everybody, I say, I drank up this side of my brain. I drug this side so it wouldn't remember that this side was missing. And if I don't write it down, I'm on God's grace all the way. So if I forget something, don't charge it to me. Say, "God, you forgot to remind her where she is and what she needs to be doing." See, today I'm trying to learn to love other people in spite of where I think they ought to be or what I think they ought to be doing. I try to tell people honestly what's going on with me. And when I get those disappointments, rather than stuff it and get you later on, I try to tell you what's going on with me right up front. And then the best part of it is let it go and keep on with it. I still pray the Lord's Prayer where it says, "Forgive us our trespasses." And the best part of that is, "And forgive those that trespassed against me." That's the best part. Learning to pray for people when they disappoint me. That is the best part. I never learned that nowhere else but in this fellowship. My son come down this weekend, and he was just, he's still in his addiction, and oh boy, he was on a trip. And I said, "Son, have you thought about praying?" And I got a radio show. God even blessed me with a radio show. I'm a gospel announcer on a radio station. I made a tape, you know, just for that. I gave him that tape. And he called me back yesterday. He says, Mama, there's really a new you. He said, I believe something is working in your life. And I wanted to gloat and say, you better try it, kid. But I didn't. I just said, yes. I surrendered to something greater than me because what I was doing wasn't working. And I don't know, I led them kids into everything I did. They all had their little motorcycles. They drank like I did. They drug like I did. But they're resisting this recovery. They're resisting, but that's okay today because you all said that we are examples by sight. And that if I just continue to come to my meetings regularly, don't pick up, don't drink, get involved in service work, have an honest desire not to drink anymore, get a sponsor, then I'll be okay. Today I'm the alternate DCM for my district. I go to Macon River, that's where I met Danny. They said get involved, I got involved. I like history. Because someone told me, if you don't know where you've been, you're subject to go back. I don't want to go back to where I've been. I hear people sometimes say they want to get back to where they were. Please, God, don't take me back there because I was pre-alcoholic. I don't want to go back. I want to go forward. So I do stay involved. I do a detox meeting at Charter Peachford every Tuesday nights. I go over there and I do a service in detox. Because I believe that if I continue to stay in service work and keep busy, and I'm still obsessive and compulsive, but I do it with my program now. I try to go to meetings as regularly as I can, and when I can't, I make sure that I have some sponsors. She's busy. She's alcoholic too. She's busy around the clock. We call each other and give each other hug messages. We call her up and I say, here's a hug for you. And she'll call me back. She'll say, here's a hug for you, Virginia. And I put my messages on her answering machine. I hear people call me up, won't talk to me. I hear the phone click up. I don't. I call my sponsor and I talk. And when it runs out, I call back and say, part two. And I have found out that nobody interrupts me when I'm on the answering machine. I can say everything I want to say. Nobody interrupts. You know, when I talk to people, they always say, yeah, me too. And when they get done, they're doing the talking and I start to listening. But on the answering machine, I can say everything I want to say. I love an answering machine. I do. And I tell her to extend the time on it because I have some long talking to do. So I even call myself up on my own answering machine and say, Virginia, I love you today, girl. And I come home and play that machine, I say, you do. I'm so glad somebody loves me today. Me. You know, everything is not just the way, but I'm learning not to compare myself with others. I'm learning that what's right for me may not be right for everyone else. I'm learning through the steps that if I take an inventory of my part, I can usually see what's going on. If I keep the focus off about what you did do and didn't do, I do better. I have to share a bathroom in this rooming house, and this bathroom was driving me crazy because it seemed like nobody else cleaned this bathroom but me. And I was having a terrible resentment because I'd scrub this bathroom, take my shower, go to work, come back in. The bathroom was messed up. And I was about ready to kill some of my tenants. You know, I got to that point. And finally someone said, you better take care of yourself, Virginia. And I put a lock on the door. And it kind of bothers me. Because I give the keys to people and they still don't clean the bathroom. So I turned around, I had to start praying and turn it into service work. See, that's what I have to do when stuff goes to bother me. I have to find something positive about what's bothering me and then turn it over to my higher power. So I look at that bathroom and I take a deep breath and I just go on in there and clean it up and take a shower, you know, and try to keep the focus on who did it and who did it and who didn't do it. Because when I get caught up with who did it and who didn't do it, I just have to pray for that, you know. And that one day God will give me my own bathroom again. I used to have my own bathroom, but see, I gave it up for the drugs and alcohol. And folks, if you've had to live in somebody else's bathroom, let me tell you, you can have a lot of humility, and you know when you get your own bathroom again, you're going to treat that bathroom right. I'm going to treat that bathroom good. That's going to be the prettiest room in my house if I ever get my own bathroom. But until I do, I just practice this program, try to keep the focus on myself and ask God to do for me what I can't do for myself. And no matter what, I surrender today. I do not want to drink. No matter what, I had found a dead man up in there. My disease says, baby, you need a drink. Get you a case of Budweiser. Now remember, I don't like Budweiser, but that's what my disease said. And I had to stand right there before I took care of this situation and make a commitment to my recovery. No matter what, I will not drink today. Not today. And as soon as I had that little incident taken care of, I jumped in my car and went straight to a meeting. Today, my recovery is the most important thing in my life. I don't know about tomorrow, but I know today my recovery is the most important thing in my life. I want to stay sober. I even like going to meetings. I have this feeling inside of me that if I stay here, I'm only at the tip of the iceberg. If I stay here, great things will happen to me. And if they don't happen out there, they are happening here. And I'm here to tell you that I'm no different than any one of you out there. If my higher power saved me, guess what? Save any one of you too. Because I found out when it rains on all of us. And if the blessings rain down on any of us, they'll rain down on all of us. And that none of us ever, ever have to go back to that life again, one day at a time. Thank you for letting me share.